Hello, fellow movie lovers, and welcome to Cult Fiction, a podcast where we examine Hollywood's redheaded stepchildren. As a redheaded stepchild myself, I'm Stephanie Johnson.
And I'm Andy Bowell. And today we are pulling back Hollywood's script to review the 2002 black comedy, Death to Smoochie.
He slams the door, he stomps his feet, sends me to bed with zilch to eat. But my stepdad's not mean, he's just adjusting.
Which I kept referring to as Death to Snoo Snoo, and no, I'm not a Futurama person, it's just what stuck in my brain.
Honestly, Death to Snoo Snoo is probably a better movie than this.
This movie could either have been a half hour shorter or a half hour longer, and it would have been a better movie. Like, it could have either taken the time to make the commentary it was trying to make and failed to make.
Right.
Or it could have been lightly funny and cut out a lot of the, like, not really thought through commentary and been fine, I guess.
Yeah, like, just to get to it. This movie's a fucking mess.
It's a lot.
It is a lot. And yeah, like you say, it kind of tries to balance, like, it's got a bunch of plates spinning in the air. One is like wacko screwball comedy that Robin Williams is known for. One is it's trying to do the thing Network did and make you care about, like, the deep personal power plays of TV network executives. And, like, have some sort of social commentary, but it's trying to keep all these plates spinning at once, and it only has one hand because the other one is, like, caught in the Smoochie costume.
Well, and you even said, like, this is a black comedy, but it's not actually funny.
No, it is very much not. There are a couple of things that work in Death to Smoochie, but for everything that works and everything that I find amusing in any way, shape, or form, there are three other things that not only just don't work, but, like, actively go the other direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are so many problems.
Well, okay, so getting this out of the way, in case you missed it, Death to Smoochie.
Which turns out is a tongue twister.
Death to Smoochie. So it's like a cringe romp fueled by mouth harps and rainbows and a lot of, like, Barney adjacent media through the darker side of children's shows. And then we have Smoochie, a life-size rhino, being the last source chance for a specific kids network on the edge of disgrace. But their new character of Smoochie has made a lot of enemies just by being himself and the fallout therein. So we just have doomed from the start Ed Norton getting stalked by Robin Williams. And there's the Irish Mafia. It's a lot.
It's a lot. It's so much. Where to begin? Here's where I'll begin. There is a Jim Carrey TV show called Caring. And the plot of Caring is, what if Mr. Rogers, in his real personal life, had his young son die in a car crash? And it, like, breaks him and his family mentally. But he's still trying to do the Mr. Rogers show. And it's a brilliant series. And it does what I think Death to Smoochie was trying to do so much better.
Yeah.
Throughout this entire time, all I could think about, because this film is so much about canceling.
Yeah.
The canceling of beloved children entertainer characters. All I could think about was the Paul Rubens scandal. Are you familiar with this? Do you Pee-wee Herman?
Pee-wee Herman, and he masturbated in a theater, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Pee-wee Herman masturbated in a pornographic theater. That's a very important word to include. That doesn't, I would argue, makes the crime at least less horrifying. But went through a scandal, and Pee-wee's Playhouse was like kind of pulled off the air. And I think that somewhere somebody was like, oh, I want to riff on that. I want to play on that.
And that would have been good because, like, okay, here's the thing. Smoochie, the guy within Smoochie, Edward Norton's character, who is so much Smoochie that I forgot the character's name.
Sheldon Mopes. And I only know that because I just saw it.
So there you go. But he's so effervescent and focused on, we're doing this for the kids. We're going to make this without major vendors. We're going to do this without GMO-fueled food. He has this whole thing about how he is a vegan and he's out at like a diner and he says that he got them to order vegan dogs, the protein of the future, which if... Alex is vegetarian, so I've had the unfortunate displeasure of eating a few vegan dogs, and I just don't. Just don't.
Yeah.
Just avoid them. Eat Fair other enough. Things. My point being, it's so... He is such a wholesome person, and the pursuit of this movie is, oh, and he gets so turned.
Yeah.
By children's media and the back and forth and owning it and stardom, and it's this whole thing, but they don't go far enough.
No, because at the same time they're trying to make that movie, they're also just letting Robin Williams do whatever you want, whatever he wants, which normally is the play and the move.
Yeah.
And what Robin Williams wants to do is do foul-mouthed, like, improv comedy, because this is dead center in the middle of Robin Williams's dark period. The two movies he made before this were one where he plays a serial killer and one where he plays a serial stalker who dreams about being a serial killer. And then he did this.
This is our second Robin Williams role where we've gone, oh, hey, Robin Williams is in this. This isn't a good movie.
Well, no, that's the trick, is like, good Robin Williams movies aren't cult because they're beloved by everyone.
Sure.
And remembered fondly.
Well, I was thinking about how, like, this isn't the only Robin Williams role where he's, like, also a children's beloved TV star. Because in Mrs. Doubtfire, at the end, he makes her this whole character, which is great. And then we have Robin Rainbow or Rainbow...
Rainbow Randolph.
Rainbow Randolph. And what a treat he is. The only thing I love about him is that he has this rainbow sequin blazer that I wanted.
Yeah, and that's probably the best thing about him. Because here's the thing. Rainbow Randolph is not a character. This bugged me as soon as I realized it, but like the movie opens with a, you know, fake out taping of the Rainbow Randolph show where we just see him dancing around and singing a meh children's Mr. Rogers knockoff song. And then I don't even remember what the thing that gets him canceled is, but he gets canceled and immediately goes into like this he was taking bribes from people to have kids, like, have better spots on his show. And, yes. And they caught him on it. And, like...
The FBI, because for some reason the FBI cares about children's media.
The FBI probably cares about money.
Sure, there's not a lot of money in children's media.
Well, that's how they caught him. No. The next time we see him, he's talking to Jon Stewart at like the docks, and he's very manic and upset and like already obsessed with revenge. And we never actually get any real character of Rainbow Randolph. He's just, what little character he is he's this disgusting, petty, cruel, callow, selfish, just caricature of a thing.
He's Krusty the Clown.
Oh, Krusty has so much more heart than Rainbow Randolph.
Okay, but he's that same sad, like, this is the end of my career, this is all I can do, but it's my entire personality.
Yes, and you know what? I do appreciate the comparison. I think that's actually really apt and really brilliant.
Oh my God, thanks.
I do, like, I can think of any number of jokes where Krusty is, like, just saying something out of the corner of his mouth or just being a, you know, complete asshole. Krusty is, the Simpsons writers are so much better than the writers of this movie, I guess.
Correct.
Is what the thing is. And just, he's not a character. He gets, you know, a very obvious, like, redemption, third act, turnaround.
That feels very random.
It kind of comes out of nowhere, but, like, you know it's going to happen because... Yeah. It's kind of the only way this movie can go.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is the second returning to Cult Fiction, Robin Williams. And once again, Robin Williams is far from the best thing in this film, which is not what I would have expected before seeing it.
You better grow eyes in the back of your fucking head, you horned piece of shit, because I'm not gonna sleep until worms are crawling up your foam rubber ass. I'm going on safari, motherfucker. Safari.
Well, before you came into this movie, what were you expecting? I'm very curious.
So I remember seeing the trailers for this movie. I remember it being spoken about as like, oh, it's a black comedy. And the one conversation we had about it, Alex was like, oh, I saw that and it was really bad. Good luck. And I was like, no, you know, I mean, it's got Ed Norton. It's got Robin Williams. Danny DeVito is a competent director. Like, this is going to be like some weird, zany, like probably really great, but it was wrong for the time. Kind of like mystery adventure whodunit thing, and that works for like 10 minutes of the film, and then you just realize oh no, this is not right for any time, and that thought compounds in your mind until you're sitting there being like, is Danny DeVito a good director?
He directed Matilda. He has to be a good director.
He directed Matilda. Can he only direct children's movies? No, he directed the fucking Jimmy Hoffa movie. Like,
he directed a Jimmy Hoffa movie?
Oh, yeah, where he played Jimmy Hoffa. And Jack Nicholson murdered him.
Perfect. A+. Let's go watch that movie instead of watching this movie.
I mean, fair. Yeah, this has Ed Norton immediately coming off of Fight Club and American History X. Like,
oh, like that Ed Norton.
Yes, because I was like, oh, my God, it's baby Ed Norton. But it was like, you've made it, Ed Norton. Ed Norton.
Here, Ed Norton, be in a movie with Robin Williams. Unfortunately, you're going to be a rhino, and it's going to be a terrible script.
And I would argue Sheldon, Ed Norton Sheldon, is maybe the best part of this movie.
None of the acting in this movie is bad.
Oh, I would argue Robin Williams' acting is actually bad.
No, he's just on so much coke.
This was 2002. I hope he was sober, but I don't know.
I don't think he was sober for this. He doesn't act sober for this.
That's fair.
So, okay, another thing that I want to talk about. We're talking around how awful this movie is, but the weird cinematography in this movie was something you and I looked at each other and we were like, what the fuck is happening?
Yes, and I have a thing I could say, but I don't want to jump on your point.
No, that is my point. So we have the first scene where we see Smoochie, and we've got like chin shots and like dark, like weird angles,
yeah,
and very bizarre lighting. And I'm just like, what is going on here?
This is not my Oscar. and I say this movie has maybe the most offensively bad cinematography I have ever seen.
Oh, we love a film student getting offended.
Just, I mean, it's the old classic, could I have filmed this? And like, maybe I couldn't. Maybe I would have gotten really nervous in Times Square. But you know what I wouldn't have done is a bunch of weird, random, extreme close-ups on people's eyes and lips. And like a shot where I want Ed Norton and Robin Williams' face in the same frame. So I'm going to stick the camera like 2 inches in front of Robin Williams' cheek so that you see Ed Norton in the background. It's weird. It's weird as hell. And like I looked up, the cinematographer is a guy I have not heard of named Anastas Mikos. And like he has a career. The dude has gone on to like work steadily, and I have no idea how, because I was grinding my teeth at how much I despised a lot of his choices in this. And I truly feel like Danny DeVito just went like, well, I'm acting and my name is on there as director, but like, do whatever you want. It's fine. Yeah, okay, whatever. No, it's fine. I have to go talk to the writer and try to salvage this thing.
I mean, maybe. I just think, okay, you watched Strictly Ballroom with me outside of this show.
Indeed.
It's also on our list. But there's a shot specifically in Strictly Ballroom where they zoom in on Barry Fife's face and he goes, no new steps, and it's just his lips, and he kind of looks like Donald Trump, and that's what the cinematography is like.
But that's okay, because in the context of Strictly Ballroom and in the context of that scene, in the context of that character, it is justified. He's doing the John Lithgow there will be no dancing in this city thing, only it's there will be no new dancing in this dance hall thing.
And bravo, you've made my point for me. Thank you. Good night. I'm done. I can go to bed now.
It's not at all justified in Death to Smoochie. It is truly just random. It is truly just like it happens in the middle of scenes for no good reason. And it'll happen twice in a row and then stop. And there's so much about this film that doesn't feel justified, which is why it bothers me so much.
Well, and it's so interesting because I want to say that this is a movie that it would make sense if we were like, oh, it was on a really tight time schedule and they made what they made, because maybe with 3 more passes at the script and maybe with an extra 2 weeks of shooting and maybe with, you know, X amount more in the acting budget or X amount more in the costume budget, it could have been just that much better. And it's not there. And they were like, yep, that's the final project.
Yeah, and there's no reason I can figure out other than like, everybody who was involved with this thought that they were making a slightly different movie. One person thought this was a screwball comedy. One person thought this was like an amusing mystery whodunit drama. One person thought they were just remaking Network. Robin Williams was like, oh, this is a paycheck.
I mean, Jim Carrey was attached to this movie at one point, but he dropped out to do The Majestic.
Right, and so he was going to play Ed Norton, and like, I don't know that that would change anything. Because, like, again, Ed Norton is fine. Catherine Keener, returning to Cult Fiction, Catherine Keener as the female lead and love interest. She's fine. She's just doing random stuff. She turns on a dime between hating Ed Norton's character and being like incredibly passionately, earnestly in love with him.
Because they both watched the same children's media character TV show.
Yeah. Which also, real quick, my own personal headcanon and something that did in fact make the movie better for me was to imagine that Catherine Keener was playing her same character from Being John Malkovich just later in life after she inevitably divorced Cameron Diaz.
Mm-hmm.
And just like moved on and winds up in this insanity.
Winds up in the children's media business and is like, okay, sure, I'll do this now. This is why I'm hardened. I've already gone through all of this bullshit.
Yeah, exactly.
I knew Merv Green was a fucking jizz bag from the day he grabbed my ass at a Feed the Children benefit.
I actually love that headcanon.
This is a movie you gotta cling to things that actually work and make sense, because there's so much that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to have Michael Rispoli, who is an actual good actor, play an offensively bad character in this film. He plays Spinner Dunn. He plays the character who acts incredibly unintelligent because he has had so many concussions because he's a boxer, which feels like a really, like, somebody walked across the street so they could make some really offensive mentally handicapped jokes.
Uh-huh.
And that was the only way they could justify it and still, like, have the character be what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if this movie is made 10 years earlier, Spinner Dunn is not a boxer. He is just a
mentally handicapped person.
Mentally handicapped person, and nothing about the movie changes, including when he's murdered.
Out of curiosity, what role do you know him best from?
Oh, so yeah, here's the thing. I say Michael Rispoli is a good actor, and that's because, like, I absolutely went through his IMDb because I was like, what the fuck did this guy do? And, like, there's no one thing I can point to, but, like, he was in 24 episodes of The Deuce, which I understand to be a really good HBO series, and, like, has just been in a bunch of things. Things that I'm like, well, that's good. He was in Magic City. I love Magic City. I don't remember who he is in Magic City. He's in The Rum Diary. He's in the Kick-Ass movies. Like, this guy clearly knows how to act, and it wasn't just a favor to Danny DeVito to have his friend in him. What role do you know him best from?
I'm sorry. I wanna rewind. He was in the Kick-Ass movie, so he's a good actor.
The Kick-Ass movies are a lot, but they're not bad.
Hey, Luce, is this guy bothering you? Because it looks like he's, you know, leaning. He's in While You Were Sleeping.
Oh.
He's that guy in While You Were Sleeping, which that example of what just happened, that's an example of why we started this podcast, of just, like, quoting movies at each other.
Indeed.
He was in While You Were Sleeping, and that's why halfway through this movie I tilted my head and went, that's not... Oh.
Fascinating. Okay.
Yeah, so I have a very personal connection to that actor.
I mean, go off. I have nothing against Michael Rispoli. What led us talking about is me being like, I know this man to be a better actor than the material he was given.
I mean...
Yeah.
Are you wearing the black bra? I love black underwears.
My name's Spinner.
Oh, I know. It was so offensive. It was so terrible. And halfway through the movie, I was like, okay, I know that they're trying to make this very Of Mice and Men. And it's just not there.
I don't mean to keep arguing with you lightly. I feel like they were just like, wouldn't it be funny if there was a dumb one? How do we get away with that?
How do we get away with making someone handicapped in the year of our Lord 2002?
Right. With, like, a wholly unnecessary character. Because he's only there to endear the Irish Mafia to Sheldon. And, like, you could very easily endear the Irish Mafia to Sheldon and vice versa any number of different ways.
I think the reason he's the easy tie-in for the Irish Mafia is that it's like, okay, we need a driving force behind Sheldon that isn't children.
Sure.
So we need an adult, we need a powerhouse on his side, and he's not necessarily going to have the network because he's a network pushover because he's so nice and friendly.
Sure.
And it's only through the inclusion of the Irish Mafia that he actually gets anything.
So here's how you do it. Keep Spinner, just give him 12 less concussions, and make him the only other genuine good person in this movie.
Oh, but then you would forego Irish Mafia Mommy, and I love her.
No, you can still have Irish Mafia Mommy who loves her beloved son or brother or however they're related. You can do everything you do, only, like, Spinner's, like, a genuine good guy and, like, an actual lifeline for Sheldon. And then we actually give a shit when he dies.
I keep forgetting he dies.
He dies horribly.
I blocked out a lot of this movie.
That's fair.
And so did Roger Ebert, because he proclaimed it the worst movie of 2002.
Well, what else you got for...
What else you got for 2002? Okay, yeah. Movies that were made in 2002. I'm here for it.
While you do that, I'm going to say one thing. And I think, listeners, if you haven't watched the film, this is maybe the most indicative thing I can point to as just shit that didn't work or maybe got rewritten. For the first two times you see him, Harvey Fierstein's character is draped in shadow. They try to make this whole mystery thing of who is the character of Merv, who is this shadowy media conglomerate that people keep talking about. But first of all, that's really stupid when it's Harvey Fierstein, one of the most iconically, instantly recognizable voices in Hollywood. And then they just show him in, like, his first scene and never make a thing of it again.
Yeah, because it's the argument of the monster from Signs. It's when you see him that it matters.
It didn't matter before because I was like, that's Harvey fucking Fierstein. But the fact that they just kind of go, oh, this doesn't work because it's Harvey Fierstein. Should we reshoot those scenes? Nah.
Incidentally, 2002 was a big year for, like, really good movies.
I believe that. Was that the year we got Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon?
I'm not sure. I'm only in the first 50.
Fair enough.
But that is the year that we got Lilo and Stitch, The Ring, Chicago, Treasure Planet, Red Dragon, there you go.
Hell yeah.
About a Boy, Sweet Home Alabama, Signs, Gangs of New York, Ice Age, 28 okay. Days Later, Bourne Identity, Resident Evil, 8 Mile, Scooby-Doo, Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. But all of this to say, like, it's also the year we got The Hot Chick.
Sure.
It's also the year we got We Were Soldiers and The Time Machine.
Oh, We Were Soldiers. Oh, that jingoistic movie.
Panic Room. Cabin Fever. The Sweetest Thing. Queen of the Damned.
At least three of those movies are on the list.
Good Lord, save my soul. But the whole point of us saying this movie is so bad is that it could have been really good.
It was a couple rewrites and maybe having somebody other than Danny DeVito direct or having somebody other than Danny DeVito be in the movie away from being enjoyable.
How much does this movie change for you if you have someone who isn't as comedic as Danny DeVito as the agent? Someone a little more slick, someone a little more slimy.
Huh.
So, like, Alec Baldwin. How much does that change the tenor of the movie for you if Alec Baldwin is the agent?
I think it gets a little better. I don't think Danny DeVito does anything wrong in this movie or is the worst part. I just more think the only thing I can guess is he was distracted by doing both.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make sense because, again, he'd done literally the same thing but more when he made Hoffa. But, arguably, I would rather see Alec Baldwin. I would absolutely see Hank Azaria instead of Jon Stewart, which is what it was supposed to be. And it is so random Jon Stewart is in this movie.
We both tilted our heads and we were like, is that baby Jon Stewart?
Is that baby Jon Stewart? And then 2 seconds later, I shout, that's the fucking gangster from Home Alone?
Who plays the gangster from Home Alone? What?
So the, like, he only has 2 scenes, but, like, the network president, the old guy who is, like, yelling at Jon Stewart after Rainbow Randolph gets canceled, is the gangster in the movie Angels with Dirty Faces from Home Alone. He's the guy who believes you, but his Tommy gun don't.
Oh, he's the one who says filthy animals.
Yes.
Okay. I was going to say Marv or the other one, but then I'm now realizing you meant the actual gangster, not one of the wet bandits.
Indeed, because they're bandits, not gangsters.
Oh boy.
Incidentally, we watched Home Alone, like, because it's not Christmas until you watch Home Alone. And then, like, on Christmas Day, Mariah and I watched Home Alone 2 for the first time ever.
Which, why?
Because it's also a Christmas movie.
Sure, I guess.
It was more enjoyable than Death to Smoochie.
I was just trying to help the children.
Oh, you like kids, huh?
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
I bet you know some fairy tales then. Hey, Danny, tell him the one about the worthless prick that gets his head chopped off with an axe.
Okay, so we've been hating on this movie a lot, and it kind of reminds me of a societal trend.
Okay.
So, okay, Andy, okay, I want you to travel back with me to when you were in, like, second grade.
Okay.
At that time, at second grade, were you watching Barney?
No, and I know this because in first grade, a bully made fun of me for watching the Potty Rangers, aka the Power Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so, like, upset by it that I stopped watching Power Rangers. And I was absolutely watching Power Rangers later than I was watching Barney.
Okay, so you were bullied about watching a certain children's show. Do you remember ever being bullied about watching Barney or hearing other kids be like, Barney's for babies?
Yeah, absolutely. Barney became an intense source of ridicule and, like, that certain kind of elementary school derision where it's just like, you're bad and you should feel bad for watching Barney.
So this is a whole societal trend that I find absolutely fascinating. When media stops being appropriate for a certain age group.
Okay.
And then, so for example, Mariah was telling me the other day that y'all have started watching episodes of Bluey on TikTok before bed.
Yes, we absolutely have.
Now, Bluey is don't get me wrong, as a children's show goes, it's pretty fantastic. I have it on record that my brother-in-law doesn't let my niece and nephew watch a new episode of Bluey without him. Sorry, I'm saying that on tape, Reggie, but it's true. And, like, because it's such a good children's show, it's funny, it's smart, it's got sass, it's got some, like, adult humor that's actually really fun for adults to watch along with kids.
Yeah.
So the whole thing with Barney was that it was just for kids. There's a lot of children's media that's, like, that tries to do the Sesame Street, for example, tries to do the, we are entertaining for adults, but we try to be we are entertainment for children,
yeah,
but we try to be entertaining for adults too.
Sure.
That's kind of part of what Sesame Street does, is it's education, but it's very aware. Parents are tired. Parents are going to be watching this with their children. We don't want to bore parents.
Yeah.
So the problem with Barney is that Barney is very specifically written just to be a children's show, such that so many people have focused on this trend that there's documentaries, there is literature, there are articles written by like Yale University researchers.
I believe it.
Around what Barney represents for a preschool television show and focusing on how it's literally meant for children. It's not meant for adults. It's not meant for anyone over the age of 6.
Yeah.
And I think it's really fascinating how, as a culture, like, we age out of a certain level of media. And that's kind of represented in Death to Smoochie, if you really zoom in and peel at it, of, I only have so much time in this limelight. The kind of clutching and screaming at this, here is my time, I'm gonna hold to it so deeply. Does that make sense? Am I just rambling?
No, it makes sense, but it makes me think that is what didn't get included in the final draft of this film.
Correct.
Because that is clearly the emotional pathos of the film. That's how you make Robin Williams' character interesting, is you have him go, I know I fucked up, but I'm not ready to stop being Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
And everything that goes with that, which the film like kind of tiptoes around, but never actually addresses or gets into. I think that's a brilliant salient point, and I really wish that Adam Resnick and Danny DeVito had thought of it.
Well, so in a 93 newspaper article, Jerry Franklin, who is the head of Connecticut Public Television, they co-produced Barney, said that when adults don't like Barney, in a way they take it as a compliment because Barney isn't designed for the parents.
Sure.
We think Barney speaks to children at their level. It's simple terms. It's music. Yes, it's repetitive because that's what speaks to preschool age children. And I wanted so badly for Death to Smoochie to go there and go to the point where it's like, you only have so much time to capture this very particular, very salient audience.
Yeah.
They have this whole thing about singing songs about my stepdad's not mean, he's just adjusting, which is absolutely a song for a specific time, a specific period, a specific situation, but it doesn't go deeper. And that was my frustration with the movie.
And what I'm going to say, I'm going to recommend to you and also just listeners, like, this is a genuine recommendation, the Jim Carrey TV show Kidding. I said it wrong before. Also ask Catherine Keener. But it is the encapsulation of everything we're talking about, because it's basically a show. Imagine Mr. Rogers, only Mr. Rogers is fighting with his network executive because he wants to put a song in the show about why it's okay to feel sad that your mom's going to die from cancer. Like, it gets fucking heavy and interesting and deep and manages to be really funny.
Interesting.
It's everything Death to Smoochie is not, is what I'll say.
Okay, I'm here for that.
We didn't even talk about it, but there is a Nazi rally in this movie.
Oh yeah, there's a lot.
The Nazi rally makes absolutely no sense, and I kind of feel like they only put it in there because they were like, yeah, it worked for Blues Brothers.
And right after the Nazi rally is part of why Smoochie temporarily gets canceled.
Yeah.
And when it's disproven that Smoochie is not in fact a Nazi, the first thing he has is an episode, a segment where he comes up from a trap in the ground, a trap in the stage, and he's wrapped in an American flag.
Yeah.
And he dances to like American bandstand type music.
Which, hearing you say out loud, it occurs to me that that moment could have been like really funny in a satirical, jingoistic kind of way. And instead, it was just a moment that I watched and didn't care about because the film had already lost me.
It was a moment we watched and I went, oh, that's the most... You and I both said, oh, that's the most realistic thing.
Indeed.
Just in terms of media and how we slant ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. And that makes me think about how, like, this movie is very unrealistic about media and specifically media fallout. Because in reality, Rainbow Randolph would have gotten, like, kicked off his show and then 3 months later been on Fox talking to Tucker Carlson and, like, giving financial advice.
Oh, no. But absolutely true. And I also think that moment is just so salient, and then it's completely, like, we just go by it.
Yeah.
It's not even a thing. We don't talk about it. The only other political moment that happens in that episode is that Smoochie is talking about depression and going out at the end of the night, and he gives, it's, his song is like The Howl, and he talks about sometimes how the Smoochie just has to howl, and it's very Howard Dean, because he just deals with his depression on the show, and it's not scripted, and all the kids are sitting there like, okay.
All right. But then, like, it becomes weirdly cathartic because everyone starts doing it.
Oh, do they?
I think so.
Or is that just us giving the movie more credit than it's worth?
I mean, the kids definitely howled. I don't know how earnest it was.
Fair. Good point.
Man, I'll tell you something. All that jigging and zigging really makes me hungry. And when I get hungry, you know what time it is.
I think the moral of the story is make friends with the Irish mob.
I think so. I think that's what we learned.
I can't think of anything else that could be the moral, because that's literally how this resolves itself. Like, Sheldon has his breaking point and has a gun in Danny DeVito's face and is going to, like, throw it all away tragically. And then his friends in the Irish mob come up to him and are like, no, don't let go of your innocence, don't let go of your purity, you're a good one, stay a good one, and then, like, pat him on the butt as he's walking away and then take the gun. It's like, okay, let's have a talk, Danny DeVito.
Let's talk. Have you two boys ever taken a trip together? And so what we have learned applies to our lives today.
Indeed. Much like a children's show.
Is this cult, or is it just bad?
Oh, I think this is... I think this is just bad.
You heard it here. Bad. I want, like, the Mythbusters sound where they're just like...
Okay, done. So, like any movie, this has a bizarre... I feel like bizarre amount of people defending it online and, like... I've thought about this movie before seeing it, like, maybe once every 2 years, just like, oh yeah, there's that Barney parody movie. I bet that's funny. I'll watch at some point. But I think this movie is a fucking mess. And, like, not even in the fun way. I didn't watch this so bad it's good. I watched this with a slack-jawed, face-tilted, like, what is even happening expression for, like, the last hour.
It's a lot. And, okay, I want to say probably budget-wise, it didn't make it back.
Oh, no. Oh, no, no, no. This bombed. This bombed hard.
Okay. But it's... I guess it's quotable. It's fine. But it just... It doesn't feel worthy of being cult. But then at the same time, we've called worse movies than this cult.
Well, I'd argue the worst movies are cult. Like, there exists a level where it becomes so bad that it is actually enjoyable in such a way. And this does the worst thing of all, where it doesn't actually even reach that part.
Okay, so, okay, Andy, okay. Would you rather watch this or Beowulf?
Oh, Beowulf was such a piece of shit, wasn't it?
It was.
Oh. I would rather watch this, but I think Beowulf is more cult.
Interesting.
Would you rather watch Death to Smoochie or Howard the Duck?
Oh, I'd rather watch Death to Smoochie.
Howard the Duck is like unassailably more cult.
Unassailably. Absolutely true. Okay. Would you rather watch this or Bad Science?
Weird Science?
Sure. Would you rather watch this or Weird Science?
I'd rather watch Weird Science, and I hated that movie.
Same.
Yeah. Would you rather watch Death to Smoochie or Excalibur?
Oh, I'd rather watch Death to Smoochie.
Okay.
Shorter.
Okay, we found it. I also think, I don't remember what we said, and I'm not going to go back and listen to it, but I also think that, like, Excalibur is another movie that is so bad that it is not fun and therefore shouldn't be cult. I remember now it does have a random cult following. But again, like I said, so does Death to Smoochie, apparently. Doesn't mean it deserves it. I think it's just bad.
Well, whether it's bad or not, we do have to give it an Oscar. Are you prepared for that?
That is true. And yes, I am, because my Oscar relates to its badness.
Oh, no. You know it's hard when it's that. Go ahead.
So my Oscar for Death to Smoochie is most absolutely shoehorned and romantic subplot.
Oh, yeah.
And I talked about it a little bit, but, like, Catherine Keener is set up as this, like, butting heads antagonistic force. Like, if Death to Smoochie was Chris Farley, Catherine Keener would have been David Spade. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah.
And, like, they hate each other. They can't stand each other. There is zero chemistry between them.
Correct.
And then she sees spindly-ass Ed Norton, like...
Shirtless
Ed Norton, who, like, didn't have the toning he had for Fight Club. Although he wasn't the ripped one. Brad Pitt was in that movie.
Oh, I detect a wee bit of body shaming here.
Fair. She sees Ed Norton without a shirt, without commenting on anything about his physique, and seeing him without a shirt has her go, oh, you know what? I'll give this a shot. And then, like, two scenes later, she is deeply, purposefully, earnestly in love with him, and he with her, and, like, it just doesn't work. Somebody was like, hey, guys, you gotta have a romantic subplot in the film, when you didn't.
When you didn't,
it gets weirdly slut-shamey, Catherine Keener's arc.
It gets weirdly slut-shamey because during my Oscar, it comes out that she is, and how does Robin Williams put it? Something along the lines of she's a mascot chaser. She's here for the Muppets. She has a fetish for felt.
Jesus. She has a fetish for children's entertainers.
She has a kink for Kermit. I'll keep going.
I know you can. I'm going to stop you here, though.
But, okay, so she has a thing for children's entertainers. This comes out during Oscar 4, the most calm gunside holdup.
Sure.
Because Robin Williams' Rainbow Randolph comes out and holds Sheldon Mopes and his love interest.
Yeah, I don't remember her name. It's just Catherine Keener.
Good Christ. he holds them captive at gunpoint, and they're just fine. They're just talking to him. They're like, hey, but here's the thing, though. And, like, it's slightly elevated, but it's nowhere near as elevated as it should be when one of them has a fucking gun in his hands.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They play it, she particularly plays it like she knows he's never going to shoot, but we've seen this man come inches away from self-immolating himself, and like...
That's a pet peeve of mine.
What?
When people say self-immolating himself, obviously he was about to self-immolate himself. Who else do you self-immolate?
Fair enough.
Sorry. This is like the third time this has come up. I'm sorry. He was 2 inches away from self-immolating.
I mean, and he appears to be like an unhinged man on the edge, and like they don't have any good rapport, and they haven't the entire movie. So like it's yet another thing that is totally unjustified.
This movie just lacks buy-in.
This movie lacks buy-in. It's occurring to me this movie fails the Bechdel test.
Oh, for sure.
Because there's only two, like, female speaking roles, period. It's Catherine Keener and the Irish mob lady, Tommy.
Irish Mafia Mommy.
Irish Mafia Mommy, Tommy.
Oh, so nice. But you know who always has time for Irish Mafia Mommy?
So would you like to go first or shall I?
I'll let you.
Okay. So for my bacon, I can do it in two films. Ed Norton was probably the best part of this film, and I like to reward that in my bacons when I can. And I realized Ed Norton is in Birdman with Emma Stone. Amazing movie. Much better. Wish I'd been watching it instead of Death of Smoochie. And Emma Stone is in Crazy Stupid Love with Kevin Bacon.
Fair enough. Well played. You did it in two. I'm very proud of you. I also did it in two, but it's very important to me how I got to two.
Okay.
Because Michael Rispoli, aka Spinner Dunn, was in While You Were Sleeping with Sandra Bullock, who was in Loverboy with Kevin Bacon.
Okay.
I wanted to go with him because he's so beautiful to me.
Of course, of course. I appreciate that. I think I'll give you like the inching forward to claim the win on the bacon there because it meant more to you and I appreciate that.
Thank you. And for the record of things that mean more to me, because, you know, we believe in women on this podcast and we've been referring to her as Irish Mafia Mommy. Irish Mafia Mommy Tommy was played by Pam Ferris.
Indeed. Fair point to correct.
I feel like it's important, you know?
Indeed.
But also important, the movie we're watching next.
Very important, the movie we're watching next, because God, you hope it's going to be a good one. Every episode of Cult Fiction, we put our hands in the Hollywood crypt. We put our hands in fate through the application of a random number generator. And sometimes it spits out a movie that I've vaguely been aware of for 20 years and go, oh, I'd like to watch that sometime. And then it's a complete piece of garbage. And sometimes it gives us an actual good movie. And we have no way of knowing, other than knowing that we have a 1 in 276 chance of it being the film Anaconda. So that's my way of saying we have 276 films on the list. And on the next episode of Cult Fiction, we will be watching number 147. 147, oh, potential, like, double feature with Death to Smoochie, because I know this to be another black comedy that people talk about a lot. On the next episode of Cult Fiction, we will be watching the Ben Stiller-directed 1996 black comedy, The Cable Guy.
Interesting. I know next to nothing about this movie, but I'm excited.
It stars Jim Carrey and he tries to kill people.
Cool. All right. Well, on that note, That's all for this edition of Cult Fiction. To keep up, follow us on Twitter at Cult Fiction Cast. You can also follow, rate, and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll close the crypt for now.
But join us next time when, in a streaming age, we look back at the way that network programming and television used to be, an archaic technology of yesteryear, as we watch Jim Carrey in The Cable Guy. For Stephanie Johnson, I've been Andy Bowell.